Hello and welcome to another episode of EngineNerds, a monthly podcast about all things engineering, coming to you from Northumbria University, Newcastle in the UK. My name's Nick Martin and I'm sat here with fellow EngineNerd Madeline Convrink. And on this episode, Craig can't make it unfortunately, so we're going to talk about aerodynamics because that's what we love the most about engineering. Okay, and so what I want to talk about this week is the fact that F1 cars can use their brakes to go faster around corners.
That's kind of counterintuitive. I think you should explain more.
Yeah, okay. So basically, an F1 car in particular, the way in which it goes fast, okay, there's a lot of reasons why it might go fast around a corner, but one of the reasons it goes fast around a corner is that it has the optimum level of grip on its tyres. And F1 tyres are, for anyone who watches F1, maybe they'll know this from watching the coverage, but they have to be in a particular temperature window. So that basically means that the tyres can't be too hot and they can't be too cold. If they're just, it's kind of like Goldilocks tyres, there's like a Goldilocks zone. So if they're too hot, then basically the rubber kind of just starts melting and it just doesn't work properly. If they're too cold, then the rubber is too firm and it just doesn't grip in the right way. And effectively, you're changing the coefficient of friction of the tyre's rubber as the temperature is changing. And if it's just in the right range, then the rubber has the highest coefficient of friction and it works like in the best way and it makes the car go around the corner faster. But, what does that have to do with brakes? Well, basically, an F1 car's brakes get incredibly hot when it decelerates. So when they get very hot, that heat radiates out into the rim of the tyre, and then the rim gets hot, and then the tyre gets hot, and so you can use the brakes, basically, to control the temperature of the tyre. And by doing a load of trick stuff with the way in which you cool the brakes, you can transfer that heat to the tyre and therefore get the tyres in that performance window and then go fast around corners.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that, but it seems like we have a general theme here this week, and that is, well, apart from aerodynamics, acceleration and deceleration. But now I have a question for you. What gas do they use in Formula One to fill the tyres up with?
Oh, good question. I think that they probably use nitrogen because it's more inert than like kind of standard. Well, I mean, standard air is like 80% nitrogen, but it obviously has... Is it 80%?
Yes, roughly. I just taught that in thermodynamics, so I should actually know that. It is roughly.
It's obviously got some carbon dioxide, yes, and some oxygen kicking around in there, otherwise we wouldn't be able to breathe. I think they use pure nitrogen. I think now I'm probably... I mean, anyone listening here who knows otherwise, please let us know and tell us that we're wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure they would probably use pure nitrogen. Certainly that's like the ideal gas to fill a tyre with because it's more inert.
And it's
so,
smaller molecules, so they don't... Yeah. Is it smaller or bigger?
I think it's bigger, actually.
No, it's bigger. I'm talking rubbish here. So it's bigger particles, and so it's not as easy for them to escape.
Yeah.
So what is really good is if you have your normal... road vehicle, if you fill up those tires with nitrogen instead of air, they stay, you know, in that condition at the perfect bar ratio for a much longer time.
Yeah, so exactly. I guess it makes the internal pressure of the tire less temperature dependent as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
It has to do with the temperature dependence, but also oxygen is a little bit sneaky. It tends to escape if you give it a chance.
Yeah. Yeah. Hence why, you know, your tires do deflate over time. They're not 100% perfectly sealed. You do have to pump them up.
Proper car maintenance is you have to check the tires and the air, depending on how much you drive, but at least every month. The oil. You have to check the oil as well to make sure that you still have the, you know, proper amount of oil inside of your sump.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the interesting things about this particular fact is that Mercedes, and this is kind of where the fact comes from. So Mercedes F1 team, they were tangled up in a bit of controversy earlier in the year, whereby they were adding some like ridges to their tire and some other kind of, sorry, not tire, to their wheel rim and some other bits and pieces, which some of the teams had protested and complained and said that they were illegal. Now, as it happens, the FIA had checked all this out and determined that actually they were doing, you know, they weren't being illegal or anything. But yeah, that's basically why they were doing this. They were adding these fins in order to kind of create a better, or make use of that thermal gradient between the disc and the rim in order to heat the tyre better and have better control over that heating process. Yeah. And I mean, and the reason this relates obviously to aerodynamics is that, you know, whilst you might think thermodynamics is kind of one subject and aerodynamics is another subject,
it's
the
same thing.
They're quite closely related, right?
It's basically the same thing. It's the same principles. You have to understand to in order to be able to evaluate the other. That's why I teach thermodynamics and fluid mechanics.
Yeah.
Because essentially it's the same subject.
I mean, maybe we should just actually say, like, what do we actually mean by thermodynamics and aerodynamics? What are those two things?
Yes, okay, so let's start off with thermodynamics.
Yeah, so for me, thermodynamics is the study of heat and energy and the way in which those two parameters kind of flow, essentially, in a system.
Yes, and how we can use that inside of an energy system to get useful work out of it. Because, for instance, if you look at something like the Rankine cycle, that is...
Which, the Rankine cycle is like basically like an idealized model of how an engine might work.
Well, or a power plant.
Or a power plant, yeah.
A power plant, but the Rankine cycle, for instance, is all about what does my system look like? How do I describe it in terms of thermodynamic properties such as entropy and enthalpy? And how can I translate that into... the work, those are very engineered terms. But
I mean, entropy is probably, we could probably do an entire podcast on entropy, I guess.
Yes, we can do an entire, on both on the just on thermodynamic properties alone and what it means and what the significance is thereof. We can do an entire podcast. But what it comes down to, the basics of both fields is the conservation of mass, momentum and energy and how it's being converted from one form to another and how we can get useful work out of that system. So your tire problem is fantastic because that is a problem where we are using heat to modify a system and to get the desired effect, the desired work out of it.
Yeah, and whilst we're on the topic of thermodynamics in general, if we'll put some links in the show notes, but if you're interested in finding out a little bit more about what this crazy thing entropy is, which maybe you might have heard of before if you're listening to this show at least, then well, there's a really good description of entropy by YouTuber Steve Mould, who uses something called a Stirling engine, which you'll find out about if you watch the video. And it's, yeah, that for me is a really nice engine. None of this, like, I don't know, if you've heard other descriptions of entropy, you might have heard of like the arrow of time and like all this kind of physics-y based stuff, whereas, you know, this is like a real engineering description of entropy.
It's really practical. For an introduction for someone who's never heard of entropy before, is I like to describe it in the beginning as a measure of chaos in the system, but then what I use is I use an image of if you have a glass of water or you have a glass of ice, which one's entropy is higher?
Yeah, the water. Oh, you're actually asking me.
The water
would have a higher entropy.
Yes, the water will have higher entropy. And the reason for that is that the particles has more ways in which they can move, while if you have... the ice, on the other hand...
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes sense. The ice is like a really ordered structure.
Yeah, it's really ordered structure. It's really... There's only so many ways in which the particles can vibrate and they can still move.
Yeah.
You know, the individual water particles, but they are frozen, so they have less options. And people will immediately say to you, no, but...
But this is why, in a way, it's a little bit... This is why it's often entropy is linked to the direction of time, because it's obvious to see how... In a glass of water, you can go from like all of the particles being in this incredibly mixed up state and then like continuing to be in a mixed up state. And it's obvious to see how you could go from a lower entropy state like the ice to this higher entropy state like the water. But it seems completely physically impossible, or actually without putting energy into the system, in terms of how you would go from being a jumbled up like kind of collection of particles in terms of water to then suddenly the particles becoming ice. Like that wouldn't just happen naturally.
Yes, you have to do something. You have to take
it. Well, yeah, you have to put it in the freezer to put energy into it. Like, you know.
Yeah, you need to put additional work to it. I don't really like that time description. The other thing.
No, I know what you mean.
I don't like that one. What I do try to stress is that it all has to do with temperature because everything is temperature dependent.
Yeah.
Now, inevitably, you need time for the temperature to get to a certain level, as we just said, but any properties that we are dealing with change with the temperature or with the temperature gradient, and that is what create the changes in entropy. But what I like most is the description of what is the difference between a reversible and irreversible system.
You're asking me the question. Okay.
So, no, but when you teach this on an entrance level, I like to get very visual and use examples that people can understand. So if I have a reversible system, I tell them take a tennis ball and throw it against the wall.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that there is no such thing as a reversible system.
That's true. Technically.
Technically,
that's true.
Yeah.
But if you take an egg and now you throw that against the wall, would you say that we are able to reverse that?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely not a reversible system.
So just to get the idea in, to get the idea across of reversible and irreversible, throwing a tennis ball against the wall as opposed to throwing an egg onto the wall.
That's a good example. Okay, so we've talked about thermodynamics.
So then
aerodynamics.
I think we first need to speak about fluid mechanics because that leads to aerodynamics.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, okay.
Or we can just go straight aero.
Yeah, so I guess aerodynamics is a specialization of fluid dynamics where fluid dynamics is looking at all types of fluid motion, and fluid is like
we need to define
both liquid and gas. So like water or air or, you know.
So we can say a fluid is something that is not a solid.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything that's not solid is a fluid.
Anything that's not a solid. So when we speak of a fluid, it can literally be anything.
Yeah.
Because we view it not in terms of is it a liquid or is it a gas. We see it in terms of fluid dynamic properties. We see it in terms of density and viscosity and those types of terms.
Yeah, and aerodynamics is specifically about the particular fluid that we're interested in is air.
Yes.
And in particular with aerodynamics, we're interested in, you know, how when the air is moving over some object or you've got some object immersed in that fluid of air, what are the forces and how are the forces acting on that body?
So now we are really speaking of external external aerodynamics, because you get the internal aerodynamics as well.
Well, I would argue that they're more or less the same. When I say, because like a body inside a flow, right, you can still have flow going through that body. I'm not saying that the body necessarily, I mean, it might be porous in some way, so, you know.
Yes, but it comes from the particular background where I come from, because if you have internal flowing flow, the processes are, no, you're right, it's exactly the same. Wipe that part.
Okay, I'll wipe that part.
Yeah, wipe that part later. It's the same, because you still have, in external aerodynamics, you still have shocks. You have shocks in the internal parts as well, and they behave the same. It's just you will have more reflections if you have internal flow.
Sure.
As opposed to when you have external flow. Okay.
Yeah.
Where do we go from here?
Okay, so we've talked about thermodynamics, talked about aerodynamics, and the reason they're related is because, you know, typically when you have heat in a system, heat can radiate, which is nothing really to do with, nothing really to do with fluid mechanics mechanisms, but heat can also be transferred through, you know, heat can flow in a fluid from one place to another, and you have things like heat transfer, which is important in things like boundary layers, and so, you know, the two are kind of related. And in this particular case, when we're talking about wheels, you've got the air that passes over the discs, and it's the, you know, part of the heat that gets radiated out into the rim is literally being radiated out, just from kind of electromagnetic radiation, literally, from like the electrons which are coming off and heating up the rim. But then part of it is the heat transfer that's physically like where the rim is heating the air up because the air is in contact with the brake, and then that air is then passing, you know, over the rim and then transferring some of that heat to the rim as well. So they're the kind of two types, I suppose, of, you know, both radiation and also heat transfer.
Where you see it particularly is when you are dealing with supersonic and hypersonic flow. The interaction between the thermodynamics and the aerodynamics is very strong.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah,
that is where it really becomes important because, for instance, if you have something flying at Mach 2 and there's a shockwave across it,
we spoke of this in previous
podcasts, it's a rapid change in density. Now, as we said previously, that all of those properties are temperature dependent. So yeah. If you have a rapid change in density, you will necessarily have a rapid change in temperature.
Yeah.
And those temperatures becomes important, especially for if you have a re-entrance pod coming in from outer space. Those interactions becomes really important.
Yeah, cool. There's just one other thing I wanted to mention actually on this, and that's that Formula One, obviously we're talking about Formula One and aerodynamics behind Formula One wheels and, you know, how that works. But, you know, actually, even in your kind of road cars, you know, your Ford Fiestas or your Nissan Qashqais or whatever, other brands are available.
Me guess, you want the Qashqai.
with the introduction of the latest kind of regulations that all car manufacturers have to go through in order to set their cars kind of CO2 emissions and basically when you go down to a dealership and you buy a car, you need to, the manufacturer needs to be able to tell you what CO2 levels this car has so that you can compare it. You know, you might want to have the most energy efficient car, for example. And so previously you used to be able to go down and you'd see one number next to your car that you wanted to buy. You would have one particular kind of efficiency rating, which would tell you like how many grams of CO2 or whatever if you're driving along a particular, well, we won't go into why, but anyway, but recently there's been the introduction of the, and I'm not going to remember the correct acronym, the WLTP, which is the Worldwide Harmonized Light Vehicle Test Procedure, which is also a mouthful, and actually it says worldwide, but they don't use it in America. They use something else in America. but this is a basically a new standard for how cars should be measured in terms of their fuel efficiency. And one of the outcomes of this particular set of standards is that if you choose a car, if you choose a particular, say, body kit and then like a particular wheel trim and like a particular set of tires to go with that wheel trim, the manufacturer has to be able to tell you specifically what the, you know, what the efficiency is, the CO2 implications for that car, not just like the generic one for that entire range. So yeah, basically what that means is that because one of the major things that you change when you're buying a car is the wheel trims, manufacturers nowadays have to go into their wind tunnels and test in the wind tunnel all of the different wheel trim options in order to check that the drag, that, you know, the aerodynamic drag that these are producing, what that is, and so they can then factor that into their predictions of how efficient their car is going to be. Because obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but the more drag a car has, the worst its fuel efficiency is going to be.
I want to tell you now about, since we are speaking of cars, car manufacturing,
yep,
about the fantastic day I had yesterday.
Okay.
So,
where did you go yesterday?
I went to the Nissan factory.
In Sunderland?
Yes, in Sunderland.
Which, you know, we're recording from Newcastle, Sunderland is just across the water, and yeah, there's a massive Nissan manufacturing
plant. It's huge! Yeah. I didn't know it was so big. I was pleasantly surprised. So
did you see the production line?
Yes, it was absolutely fabulous. But the reason I went there is I have a placement student. So how it works at the university is people can elect, or students can elect in their third year to go out on placement.
And this is where the engineering students, they're going to an engineering company and they're being paid to do engineering work even though they're not they haven't graduated yet.
Yes, and I think just on the placements, before we get to the factory, I think the placement program is fantastic because it gives them real life experience.
Yeah.
And they come back just so much more prepared for their final year. And hopefully, if they do a very good job during that placement year, a lot of students do get employed after their studies with that company.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I did a placement when I was in a undergraduate, and yeah, I mean I thought it was incredibly valuable for those reasons. And yeah, it's not just employment, like students who do placement tend to have better grades in their final year. They they're much more likely to get employed and to get employed in the areas that they actually want to go and work in. So yeah, I mean, we highly recommend all students who come to Northumbria to do placement years.
So I'm a big advocate for that. We in not all of the places in the world have those opportunities. So for instance, in my course we didn't, and I think that people that go for placements is just so much better off. But because I have a student there, I got a tour of their facilities. Now, first of all, it's massive. I was really impressed with just how big it is and the sheer size of everything. And what is also very impressive is that they have renewable energy plants on the factory as well. And I didn't see the numbers, but they have a control room where they can see exactly what the energy expenditure is and how much energy is coming in from their renewable sources.
Oh, that's cool. Did you see the autonomous robots that they've got?
Oh, that is... It was like, I don't know, a candy store, you know, yeah. In Santos Village. I love them because it's just like, you can tell about the autonomous robots. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so on the production line, they have to get all the bits from like one side of the, I mean, the site is huge. It's like miles big. And so they have like a warehouse on one side that has all the parts and then the production line on the other side. And they need to get all the parts to the production line all in the right place at the right time, in the right amounts. And they have these little robots that are completely autonomous and they follow these kind of little paths along the ground and they stop when you like, when they need to, and like they like, oh, they're really cool.
I saw one of the bigger ones. So you have those ones, but I saw one of the bigger ones that also carry parts around, and the robot was not happy because someone got into his path, so he just stopped and started beeping. So I thought that is really, it was like a Wally moment. It was like, oh, you're so adorable. Can I take you home with me? Because someone stopped one of the factory cars right in front of him. So yeah. He just stood there, get out of my way, people.
My Christmas project, I like to have a Christmas project.
Yes.
And my Christmas project this year is to build a mini autonomous car. Because I think they're really cool.
Do you know you get autonomous vacuum cleaners? I'm more interested in one of those.
I do know that you get autonomous vacuum cleaners, yeah. They're quite cool.
But back to the assembly line. I have never seen assembly lines like that before. I've seen factories and, you know, ammunition factories, which is also very interesting. But when I stood there and I saw all of the manufacturing robots and how they work in a synchronized manner, it's like War of the Worlds in there. I just looked at it and, I mean, you can just stand for a whole day there and look at the assembly line because it is so fascinating.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll put some links in the show notes. I'm sure there'll be some YouTube videos up there of, like, you know, if not Sunderland, then other assembly lines, which are just really interesting to look at, like the way in which the speed at which the robots move when they do some of these things, you know, are crazy. But also what's nice, I think, is you have areas where there's just robots doing things, but also you have like these areas where you have human-assisted so you have these kind of moving production lines where you have humans standing on there, you know, the technicians doing like the jobs, but the robots are there kind of helping them as well, which is really cool.
Yeah, this, I saw it from where the bodies are being put together.
Yeah.
And you have all of these pieces that needs to to be welded together in one spot, for instance. So you have four different robots bringing four different parts together on the assembly line. But it's quick. It is so fast that it happens.
Mm.
So they grab a piece, put it on the assembly line all together in a synchronized fashion. Then immediately the robots return to their base station to go and fetch the next piece. the piece moves on, and then there's another group of robots that does the tacking and welds the parts together, needs to be welded together. So it's a very autonomous, very fast process, but it's absolutely amazing to see. And what was really impressive for me is it's busy. It's really a busy, very hectic factory, but everything is precise. There was one space, for instance, where one of the parts needs to be maneuvered so that it doesn't hit a bracket right above the robot. Mm. And you can see that it's a really complicated maneuver, but this is a 6 degree of freedom, you know, arm that is doing the work, and it's just moving the piece past the hazardous area without hitting anything. Obviously, you know, they will not be impressed if anything gets hit because that will affect your quality. But just the amount of training that had to go into there and the amount of programming to get a robot to do that, I was just, you know, so happy when I left there. It was really like spending a day in Santa's village for me.
Yeah, no, it's an impressive factory, definitely.
Yes, and the people are really, it's a good team. You can see that, you know, they made enough time to have a discussion with me, but you can see they're really working at a fast pace, very professional. The health and safety in there is out of this world, as it should be. So I was really impressed, and the cleanliness. You know, people always think that if you go onto a factory floor, it's dirty, but this place is spotless. It's really, I had a very, very fun day.
Okay, so the next thing that we're going to talk about is what your kind of fact for this week, and what's that?
I like how you say your kind of fact for this week. Well, I got so excited about the factory, but I also do have a car fact for you. And my car fact is that it is possible for a car to collide with its own wake.
Okay, good. I think probably we need to explain a couple of things here. So what's a car's wake?
Okay, so it is the same as when you have a ship moving through water. Get that image in your head. So as the ship is moving through the water, there's a region behind it where the flow is disturbed.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and one of the reasons we are interested in that is an area where a lot of drag is also generated with an object that is moving. Now, instead of the ship and seeing the wake behind the ship, think of a car. If I have a car and a car is moving at a certain velocity, I have a region of flow behind the car that is disturbed. So one of the things that I'm very interested in is drag.
Yeah.
And drag of accelerating and decelerating vehicles, for instance. Now, drag is a very big topic on its own, but I'm going to split it up into two parts: pressure drag and skin friction drag. Now, skin friction drag is due to the viscous forces, but on a car, it is so small that we can neglect that.
When viscous forces, we mean like, you know, if you think about a fluid like air, you might not think about it as being viscous. We kind of talked about this before, but like a fluid like honey is like clearly viscous, right? But air is a fluid still, and it does have some viscosity to it that's going to cause some forces, but that those types of forces due to viscosity are going to be, you know, potentially going to be quite small, and on a car in particular.
Yes, but the main thing is pressure drag, which we also can call form drag. But the one I'm interested in is another part of the form drag, which is the base drag.
Yeah.
And that is the drag right behind the vehicle, right, on the edge.
Yeah, like where your boot is, basically.
Yes,
the drag being that generated by the boot and the rear of the car and everything. Yeah.
Yes, so that is the part that I'm really interested in. So the form drag you can optimize because that physically has to do with the shape of your vehicle.
Yeah.
But the base drag is, there's a couple of methods that you can use to reduce that, but if we go to higher speed applications, your base drag is one of the things that's really difficult to eliminate.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a vehicle and it is accelerating and you look at the wake will be much more elongated in comparison to a vehicle that was at the constant velocity.
Yeah.
Now, how a car can collide with its own wake is if you take the same vehicle and then you start decelerating it.
i.e. if it's like braking quite hard.
Yes. So in a car, you weren't always a normal car. If you brake really hard, you're not going to feel boomp, you know, as you glide with your own wake. But where it becomes important is higher speed applications and in Formula One cars.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, in Formula One, you can brake hard enough that the wake will overtake you effectively, and then that will result in less downforce, which can actually, you know, affect the performance of your car if you're not, you know, if you're not careful. If you, you know, that's one of the things that you might want to consider when you're designing your car in order to take that into account, basically.
Yes, and if that wake or that disturbed flow collides with the rear wing, for instance, that changes the whole drag profile of the car at that stage.
Yeah.
And the downforce. So that is how a car can collide with its own wake.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because, like, I think, I mean, it's traditionally, actually in Formula One now even, it's only recently, in the last kind of maybe 10 years, that Formula One aerodynamicists have really started to think about how cars move in, I'm going to use a technical term here, non-inertial reference frames. So,
oh, I love that description.
by a non-inertial reference frame, we mean, you know, when the car is, when we don't think about the car and the air as being traveling at like a constant speed, but we mean that there's some acceleration happening, either acceleration or deceleration, or, you know, maybe even a car traveling around a corner. You know, that's a car has acceleration going on there. It's not quite in the same way, but
That is just acceleration, but in a rotational manner, in a rotational frame.
And I mean, how can you tell if you're accelerating or not, right? So, I mean, if you're in a car and you put your foot on the brakes, then you feel like you're being pushed forwards, right? And if you put your foot on the accelerator, then you feel like you're being pushed backwards. That's how you know you're in a non-inertial reference frame, because
You can feel it.
And yes, it's the same when you're going around a corner. When you're going around a corner, you feel you're being pushed to the outside of the corner, right? If you're going fast enough. Not that we recommend you go very fast in your car to test this.
You know, it's like this. There needs to be a disclaimer. It's like when I teach combustion and I have to say, do not try this anywhere, not just at home. Don't try this anywhere.
And but it's a true fact that really it's only quite recently that Formula One teams have started considering that, you know, they usually consider the fact that everything is traveling at a constant speed and there's no acceleration, even though, you know, the very nature of a Formula One car is that it's constantly either accelerating or decelerating in one or another reference frame.
It's doing something. So that means that the flow have a history. And as aerodynamicists, what I think we both classify ourselves as, is traditionally...
Well, engine nerds primarily, but aerodynamicists secondly.
Engine nerds first. Traditionally, we look at, for instance, if I do a simulation, I would do it at a certain constant speed without taking account of the history of the flow and the history of the boundary layer. But what we are seeing now is that is really important, because the history affects where that object is in current space and the way in which we have determined the aerodynamic coefficients traditionally is from a steady frame without taking, you know, everything that has happened into account. Now, this is not really a problem when you are accelerating, because in acceleration you have the most favorable conditions in your boundary layer. If you accelerate fast enough, now we're totally gonna geek out, but if you accelerate fast enough, you have a turbulent boundary layer, the boundary layer can relaminarize. So if you go fast enough, it will assume the properties of a laminar boundary layer.
That's like, this is getting quite technical now, but you see this happening on wings or like on curved surfaces.
Yes.
At the leading edge of a wing, potentially, because the flow accelerates very quickly around that surface, and you get a relaminarization of an initially turbulent flow. Is that right? Am I making that up?
Yes, it's true. It's true. Yes.
Yeah.
Because but you will see it does it in the initial stages, but just then it just transitions.
Then and goes it transitions turbulent. Anyway. Yeah.
Yes, it transitions and goes turbulent anyway. Your problem comes in whenever you are decelerating, because that creates an adverse pressure gradient, which will result in flow separation. And as we said now with some of our examples of the flow going from a laminar to a transition to a turbulent state, is separation in aerodynamics is the enemy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we have talked about separation on this podcast before.
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
So whatever we do, we want to prevent the flow from separating.
Yeah.
Because that is the worst possible condition that you can get in aerodynamics, is flow separation.
So.
Yes.
Okay, so actually, talking about accelerating reference frames, okay, so like we mentioned, you've got kind of what I would call linear motion, where you have acceleration and deceleration in a straight line, and we mentioned this other kind of acceleration when you're going around a corner, which, you know, some people might associate with something called centripetal acceleration, sometimes also referred to as like a centrifugal force, maybe,
which
is kind of a fictitious non-existent force. Anyway,
let's not get into that.
We're not going to get into that.
That's a much longer conversation.
Yeah. But what's interesting actually is that, I mean, all cars that go around corners, but in particular Formula One cars that go around corners, you know, very fast, go around, you know, tight corners extremely fast in a racing track, is that what that means about the air that the car is seeing is that instead of it being like kind of straight over a car, if you imagine you're traveling in a straight line and the flow is kind of going over the car in like a straight line effectively, it actually means that the flow is being curved around the car. You get this effect. Well, it's also known as flow curvature. But I mean, if you imagine the way I think about it is, if you take your car and you were to put it on like a roundabout and spin it around the roundabout, then the roundabout is going around in a circle, and so the air that the car is seeing is effectively going in a circle, right? Or like kind of.
Yeah. Yes. So all that you did then is you just again went to a non-inertial reference frame.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And what's interesting is that all Formula One teams nowadays, all of the testing that they do, or the majority of the testing that they do, is in the wind tunnel. And they're actually quite limited in terms of the regulations by what testing they can do on the track in real life. But the wind tunnel, you can't have a rotational reference frame in a wind tunnel. It's impossible.
No.
Well, I mean, all modern Formula One wind tunnels don't have any means of creating flow curvature.
You will literally have to curve the test section and put the but that's still not going to work.
Even that isn't completely correct. You can get closer to it, but it's still not true flow curvature.
No, you won't.
You'd actually have to. So actually, there's. I could even link to a video to you of some really cool people in Australia who have looked at this. And they created a mini wind tunnel, where they put a mini Formula One car inside it, and they had to rotate the entire wind tunnel in order to replicate the correct flow curvature characteristics.
That's genius. I wouldn't just sort of take the whole tunnel and rotate.
Yeah.
Okay, but on a big scale, that's going to be troublesome.
If not impossible, actually, I think when they did some calculations to see what it would happen if you scaled it up, and like, it's just ridiculous. Like, there's no way that you could do it realistically.
But see, that is the problem with what I'm doing, working in non-inertial reference frames, because mathematically we can handle it, but testing it physically is problematic.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is one area I'm not an experimentalist. I do experiments only when necessary. Mathematically we can handle it, computationally we can handle it, but recreating those conditions in a laboratory kind of setup is really difficult.
I mean, this is the problem, because these kind of things, like in a Formula One car, they happen every time a Formula One car goes around a corner. It's something that's happening in real life. And it, like you said, it's something that we can simulate on a computer quite straight, you know, reasonably straightforwardly. We can do all the maths. But to try and like create a nice experiment to test this is actually really quite difficult.
It's really, but that's why I'm very excited about one of your projects, because you are now physically instrumenting a car.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to bridge the gap effectively. This is literally my current research that I'm doing, is to try and try and instrument a kind of scaled version of a vehicle so that we can look at these kind of effects and really kind of bridge the gap between the CFD and, you know, the computational world and the maths and what's happening in real life.
Yeah, because we do need those, all of those components, the physical world, the mathematical world and the computational world, to take hand. So we need experimental data for it. So I am very keen to see how you are going to fix this problem.
Yeah, I mean, effectively it means I just get to play around with remote control cars.
Which is what the person wants to do.
Definitely what an engine nerd wants to do. Okay, that's all we've got time for on this episode of Engine Nerds. Thanks for listening to us. If you want to get in touch with us about any of those things that we've been talking about in this podcast, you can do so via our Twitter handles. I'm on @nd_martin.
I am @ml_gombrink.
Or you can email us at enginerds.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook with our handle @enginerdsuk. And you can find all of our previous episodes on the Enginerds website, enginerds.co.uk. Now, also, just a very quick special announcement. In January, we've got our first ever live show recording at Northumbria University in Newcastle. More details, we'll put some links in the show notes. It's completely free, you can come along and you can get tickets now if you want. That's it, so thanks for listening and goodbye.